We're going to pray before we start our sermon this morning. Gracious God, we rejoice that you are with us. We are grateful for your presence among us, for that transforming power. We know that you are not ignorant of the struggles of our days, and we ask that you might intercede on our behalf, but that you might form us more crucially into the image of your Son, in whose precious name we pray. Amen. Stories about the mafia have been popular since the early 1900s. The genre itself sort of solidified in the 1930s. And there are a lot of things that sort of distinguish the mafia movie from other similar movies, like heist movies and things like that. So you have to have criminal action in the movie for it to be a mafia movie. There have to be certain kinds of tropes of insider and outsider kind of dynamics. And there are a few other things that are essential. One of those things is the presence of a large family around whom this empire of crime is organized, right? Especially in like Italian mafia movies. And in these large families, some of whom are born into the family, some of them are married into the family, you see an expression of what it means to be blood related. The commitment to the family and the family values. And you also see what it means when you betray that family. A betrayal of the family is seen as an abandonment of that collective good and goal. That you're trying to leave your family behind. A rejection of the most important thing in your life. To betray your blood is an unforgivable sort of sin. There's a more recent example of this in the 10 movies of the Fast and Furious franchise. Vin Diesel plays a character in these movies whose name is Dominic Toretto. They call him Dom. And he races cars. And on the internet, he is famous for his quotes about his family. He says things like, "You don't turn your back on family even when they do. What's real is family. Family is everything." In the ancient world, at the time of Jesus settled in the Roman Empire, they had their own ideas about families and family dynamics. It changed, of course, location to location, culture to culture, but there were some elements of it that stayed pretty consistent across the board. There was a time when your lineage, whether through your father for Roman identity or through your mother for Jewish identity, those things mattered hugely in your life. It could grant you citizenship, it could welcome you into a religious community, or it could leave you out of them. Fathers had a large amount of control in these family contexts, with mothers playing a much more minor role, if any. Children had essentially no rights and were under complete control of the father in their family. And the nuclear family, father, mother, children, was essential to ancient Roman family structures. They had adoption in the ancient Mediterranean world, but it was often done out of a need for an heir, someone to inherit. And it was often done by a nephew or a grandson, someone who was blood related to the person passing off power. When children were born first, they could also be accepted or rejected by their father. There was a ceremony about whether this child would be welcomed into the household or not. And if that child was rejected, usually because of gender, physical deformities, then that child would be put into a basket or a pot and left out in the elements for the gods to take care of. Now, Judaism didn't follow this practice. They thought it was pretty distasteful. But the other elements of the Roman structure bled into their family structures, the culture around the family in Judaism, this maintenance of the nuclear family in their households. In both cultures, there was a deep sense of family honor and the importance of family honor. This is true in most cultures, by the way, in the world, less so in wealthy Western white cultures. But the actions of any one family member were an indicator about the rest of the family, right? It was the job of the family to keep the members of their family in check. It is in this world and in this context that we read our text for today. Jesus is going to offer us another teaching, and we're going to do our best to see what he means by it. We're going to read from the book of Mark, chapter 3. We're going to do verse 20 and 21, and then we're going to read 31 through 35. Then he went home, and the crowd came together again so that they could not even eat. When his family heard it, they went out to restrain him, for the people were saying, "He has gone out of his mind." Then his mother and his brothers came, and standing outside, they sent to him and called him. A crowd was sitting around him, and they said to him, "Your mother and your brothers are outside, asking for you." And he replied, "Who are my mother and my brothers?" And looking at those who sat around him, he said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother." Here in Mark's gospel, we're catching two pieces of a fascinating scene. Jesus is at a house, not his own, probably in Capernaum, but it's somebody's house. And he is crowded into this house by a large group of people. Some of those in this group are his disciples. Some of them are religious leaders with whom he's about to have an argument. And some of them are people just wanting to know more about him. Maybe they came for the miracles he had just been performing. Maybe they came for the teachings that he was offering. Maybe they came for something else. And I think it was reasonable to argue that they were being a bit pushy, okay? They were asking too much of Jesus in this moment. We know this because it says that they don't have any time to eat. But Jesus and his disciples were also allowing it to happen. They were prioritizing the crowd and the teachings over stopping to get some dinner. And this story that Jesus has, this conversation with these religious leaders, the religious leaders accuse him of speaking with the power of the devil, of demons. And he rejects this ridiculous claim that they're making. And this is where we get the quote from Jesus where he says, "A house divided against itself cannot stand." And instead of the image that they're projecting onto him, that his divine power to heal comes from the devil, he frames himself as the one who restrains evil, who binds the power of sin and death. So we find out that Jesus' mother and his brothers have all come to this house to try to get him to tone it down a little bit. The text says that they came to restrain him, the same word that is used by him when he speaks of binding the devil. Jesus, in this story, comes off as a loose cannon. He's getting into public discussions and fights with the religious leaders, and he claims that he has the power to restrain the evil one. And his family thinks, understandably, that he has completely lost it. He's out of his mind. Worse still, these 12 disciples, new friends he has called into his service as a rabbi, are letting him drive himself crazy. So for the sake of their family image and their honor, as well as this one they love, they come to Capernaum to try to keep him in check. Normally, in this kind of a family matter, based on the social rules of the day, Jesus's patriarch would have come to tell him to shut it down. And so, because Mary is in this story, we can know two things. Number one, Joseph is probably dead at this point, because Mary wouldn't be there if he wasn't. And two, that Jesus is the eldest brother of this story. There's no one older than him but his mom who could put him in check. Nobody else has the gravitas to tell him to tone it down. But his brothers are there, and another text often tells us that his sisters are there too, to serve as compelling elements to this story, maybe some muscle if he goes completely rogue. This isn't just about intimidation tactics, though. Don't mistake this for them showing up with large guns at the door, right? They care about Jesus, their brother, their son. This is the one they grew up with. They played games with in town when the sun was going down. They worked alongside with Joseph in his construction business. Of course they want to make sure that he's not completely off the rails. So they do their job as his family and they show up. But they can't get into the house. So dense is the crowd. So they pass on the message. Tell Jesus that we're here. Now, I don't know if this was like a telephone game where they're telling one person who tells somebody else who tells somebody else. Or maybe they got somebody who was very sneaky and kind of sharp-elbowed to work their way through the crowd to get to Jesus. But they pass the message on. Tell Jesus we're here. And we see them in our minds standing outside of this house. People spilling outside the doors, sitting in the windows, listening. And that image is intentional by the writer of Mark. He's trying to tell us something. At this moment, Jesus' mother and siblings are outside of the knowledge of what it means for Jesus to be present here. They know that he's special, right? But they don't really get it yet. They are outside of that knowledge. So the message is spoken, one person to another or whatever, and taken to the disciples. And they tell him, your mother and your brothers, your siblings are outside. They've come to talk to you. And Jesus gets the message, and he looks around at the rest of his disciples, the gathered crowd, the religious leaders who are probably still fuming about the fight from a minute earlier. And he says, who are my mother and my brothers? Oh, here they are. Whoever follows the will of God is my mother and my brothers and my sisters. This response from Jesus is not just unexpected, but it is unthinkable. When his family hears it, they know with certainty Jesus has lost his mind. The family bond is a sacred thing. In the Ten Commandments, the centerpiece of the law given to Jewish people by Moses, number 5, peak of the 10, honor your father and mother. That Jesus would push back against this is unimaginable. It seems to compromise his family and the unit that they functioned as, and to change the structure of the family completely. Jewish people, of course, believed that God's claims superseded even family bonds, right? But to claim that those who obey God are Jesus' true family is only a statement an insane person would make. It goes beyond just the shifting of a familial imagery. We don't have the response of his family or the disciples in this story. We don't know how hurt Mary was by this, how sore his sister might have been, not talked to him for a few weeks. But we know that this statement is shocking to them and countercultural. At this point in our story, Jesus is home wrecking, but he's also home renovating in the way where you take the building down to the studs. When previously family was those of your blood, connected by DNA, by adoption. Now, Jesus is saying the structure of the family you thought it was, mother and father and 2.5 kids, it's over. We're throwing it out. And eventually, we see this change happening in the early church. Early Christians were known outside of their religious circles for calling each other sister and brother. And so much so that it caused issues outside of the church from people who didn't understand. Those who were unfamiliar with the religious practices of Christianity would accuse them of incest because they knew that some of those sisters and brothers were married to each other, right? So something fishy must have been up. But they didn't understand that the blood connection that made them sisters and brothers was not blood in their veins, but rather blood that covered them before God. Early Christians also dismantled the nuclear family system by beginning a new practice They started taking in those children that had been left out in baskets and pots. There was a practice to tie a certain kind of ribbon outside your house if there was a child left, in case someone wanted to take care of the kid, of course. And they would watch for them, and they would rescue those children and raise them as their own. The book of Acts also tells us that these believers, this new family, had everything in common. Nothing was off limits. They would sell property to make sure everybody could pay their bills. They ate in each other's homes every day. They were deeply involved in the lives of other believers. Jesus had taken this small structure of a nuclear family, even with 6 or 8 children, still so limited, and he busted the walls out. The family is now bigger than just blood. When we talk about family, who do you think of first? When someone asks you what counts as your family, many of you might say your spouse, your partner, your children, a close sibling or two, your parents or grandparents, an aunt who raised you, a grandfather you were close to, maybe some cousins you like a lot. And none of these definitions of family are wrong. But according to Jesus' teachings, they are too limited, too small. We can think about family as shared heritage, legal documents, DNA, or something else altogether, but all of those things, being beautiful and true, are still so small. Nuclear families matter, but to turn family into just those things is an action of isolation. It's an action of avoidance of responsibility, of unhealthy obligation, instead of shared faith and values and love. Jesus doesn't put limitations on family size or family structures. There is no perfect family, just as there is no perfect person. Families are not small, they're not exclusive, and they're not connected just by a last name. At least, not for Christians. And we know this because Jesus himself does not fit this family structure. Jesus, a single man, never married, no children. Jesus, who travels with a group of friends and financial patrons, some of whom are other people's spouses. Jesus, who has close ties to a set of siblings in a town he didn't grow up in, but strained relationships at times with the kids he did. In a world of individuality, of freedom, of personal choice, and the priority of our people, the nuclear family, Jesus offers us a challenge just as much as he offered it to them. The core of it is the same as was offered to the early church, even if the application for us might look different. Part of the reason we resist this idea is because we know there are people who are welcomed by Jesus who aren't the kind of people we want in our family. But the truth is, just like your legal family, you don't have a lot of choice in the matter. The thing about this radical family idea that Jesus offers us is that there are always going to be people in your family you don't like as much. Those who get on your nerves. And it might not always be some deeply held personal grudge that keeps you apart, but there are people you like less, you get along with less well. But in our reconstructed family, we have to know that this will be true, that there will be people we don't like, people who are unkind to us, people who are selfish against us. But they don't cease to be our family simply because of their actions, because they betray our family values, because they are unkind to us, because they're inconvenient to be family to. There are elements within our relationship, these realities, but they are not definitions for family. That is unchanging. What does Jesus say? Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother. Not whoever does the will of God perfectly. Not whoever does the will of God in a way you agree with. Not whoever does the will of God in a way you understand. It's a statement of allegiance and status, not of action. This family is not one we get to choose, but one we are welcomed into by Christ. And if we believe what Jesus is teaching here, then we have to recognize the depth of what Jesus does in this moment. This is more than just giving each other titles, though I think that brothering and sistering is a beautiful thing in churches. But it has to be deeper, because you know there are places, maybe even in this town, where they'll brother and sister each other to death, but they don't know about each other's life. They don't care about what happens. They're not involved with each other. This is about something deeper than names or titles. This is about shared identity as those who are of God. What is the teaching? Our family is not those who are of our blood, but those who are of Christ's blood. I think this makes us sort of the least nuclear family ever. We've got one father, one older brother, and then all the rest of us weird siblings. This is the family that Jesus is constructing, one of blood that covers sins, not that flows in bodies. To live out this belief that Jesus is teaching, we don't have to stop speaking to our legally recognized families, by the way. Rather, we have to begin to expand our idea of what it means to be a family and what that family looks like for us. To put it into practice for you, it might mean welcoming to your family holiday celebrations those who are not kin to you. Welcoming to your table on a regular basis people who don't share your last name. It might mean going to performances, basketball games, musical recitals for your church family, just like family does. To imagine your family as Jesus does means letting go of your anxieties about how nice your house is, how clean it might be, and welcoming people into your home without fear. It might mean paying for somebody's light bill when you know they can't pay for it this month. It might mean bringing food every time you go shopping to the blessings box, extending your table beyond the one you sit at when you eat. Thinking about family as all those who are of God means the discomfort of getting to know other people, to learning about their lives, the easy parts and the hard parts, the ones they want to tell you and the ones that take a while. It also means offering forgiveness when you inevitably upset each other and get upset. But at the core, it means allowing our shared desire to know God and to be known by God to be the defining feature for what makes a family, nothing else. And growing in greater and greater connection to those around us, and in doing so, growing in greater connection to our God.
You've been listening to me, Pastor Kana Moore, at Hayes Christian Church. Hayes Christian Church is a non-denominational fellowship in Hayes, Kansas. We are supported by the generosity of our members, attenders, and friends. The financial support we raise goes to projects which further spread the gospel to those who do not yet know Jesus, to those local, national, and international missions, and they help keep these podcasts free. If you would like to share a monetary gift with us, please visit our website at hayeschristianchurch.org and click on the donate button. Or you may mail your gift to P.O. Box 1111, Hayes, Kansas, 67601. If you have any questions, comments, or would like more information, we would love to hear from you. Simply go to our website and click on the Contact Us form. Thank you for your generosity, and may God bless you as you seek to follow Him.